Is this a good height? Can you hear me, everybody? Thank you, Joan, for being the only person who's ever introduced me and got my last name pronounced correctly. I appreciate that very much. And even people will ask me, is it, how is it, and I'll pronounce it, and they'll come up and they'll mispronounce it. So I really appreciate that. And thank you for having me here, and thank you, Chris. And this is an awesome venue. It's amazing. So tonight I'm going to read from a novel in progress that I'm working on right now called American Glass. And before I tell you a little bit about that, I just wanted to thank the Mad Women of the Attic. I'm in this 30-week-long fiction writing class with Keely Bauer, and it's amazing, and we're having a great time, and I'm working on this novel in there. Normally, I write nonfiction, creative, and otherwise, so this is a departure for me, but it's so fun because it is historical fiction. So I can still do things like research and write about stuff that actually happened, but now I get to play with it and make stuff happen that didn't happen. So I'm enjoying that. So this novel, American Glass, takes place in Moundsville, West Virginia, and you might not think that you know where that is, but I bet you do, because it has the largest conical Native American burial mound east of the Mississippi River on one side of the street and a condemned West Virginia State Penitentiary on the other. So I always tell people I'm from death on both sides. So anyways, it takes place at Fostoria Glass, which no longer exists, but it did for almost 100 years. And my grandmother, Jean, who this novel is about, it's like based on her life, her real life, and her grandmother and her mother were all glass workers there. And so in many ways, this is an homage to her and her grandmother and her mother. But it's also a novel about unionizing. When we meet Jean in this chapter, she's 21 years old, so still young and still trying to figure out who she is. And she's going to her first union meeting. And later in the novel, she becomes very radicalized and starts fighting really hard, especially for women that work at the glass house. I also want to add that when I refer to the glory hole in this novel, I'm talking about this large furnace where glass would be molten at about 2,000 degrees. And so, different historians have talked about why did they call it the glory hole. And part of it was that they said it looked like you were going to either heaven or hell, staring in this pit of molten glass. And so this is a chapter from that novel and a work in progress. Despite late February ice climbing the glass of the assembly hall windows, it was hotter than blue hell inside. Close to 400 Fostoria workers had filled the wooden folding chairs for a joint meeting of American Flint Glass Workers, Union Locals 10 and 507. They were all stripped of their coats, and many of them had rolled up their work shirt sleeves. Some of the women were blotting their sweaty faces with cotton handkerchiefs, trying to retain at least some of the faces they put on that morning. Mary Willis had just started speaking when Jean walked in and found her seat in the back row alongside Blanche Ovies, Doris Wright, Bessie Pavlak, Joyce Durham, and Betty Clark. They had all become fast friends in the past couple of years. Jean took off her burgundy wraparound and flopped herself down, propping her Mary Janes on the rail of the chair in front of her. "What I miss?" she asked in more than a whisper. Blanche leaned across Doris and said, "I don't know, some business about fair wages, but I don't think that has anything to do with us lowly sorters." Jean nodded and sat quietly for a few minutes, trying to adjust to the nearly intolerable heat. Apparently, the fan limit control switch on the furnace was out again, and they were waiting on a part to come in from Akron, Ohio. At least that's what Bessie whispered in Jean's left ear. "Lord, it's hot as a devil's rear end in here," Jean said, her voice carrying up the rows of sweaty flints, some of whom glared back at her impatiently, while her friends covered their mouths with slick palms to suppress the laughter. "You're going to get us kicked out of here, Jean," Betty warned as she tried to put on a more serious face. "They can't kick us out. By God, we're dues-paying members," she said. That sent the women over the edge, and their giggles erupted the stifling thrum of the meeting. Jean looked away from her mirthful buddies just in time to catch Mary's eyes trained on her. The vice president shook her head slightly, and Jean, embarrassed, whispered down the row, come on, girls, we better give it a listen. John Hardgrove was talking about the upcoming union convention to be held at Atlantic City. We're sending all four of our officers to represent both unions. If you have concerns that you'd like to raise with the leadership, please come up and let us know. A hand shot up in the middle of the third row. Yes, Denise, John said. Do you think you can put a stop to the building of the medic station in the glory hole? You know it's going to cost me my job, and it's just me and my little girls. I can't go back to my cold metal salary, she said in a firm and measured tone. Denise Bungard had moved into hot metal in 1944 and developed a reputation as a skilled glassblower. Her husband Danny had been killed in Okinawa, and she was left to raise their three daughters on her own. Now, Denise, John began, I think you know that no one wants you to lose your jobs or your wages, but this medic station could save lives in hot metal. You know, we've got to think about, Mary interrupts. I assure you, Denise, that we are still discussing ways to avoid demoting your girls in hot metal and bullshit, shouts a man's voice from the left corner of the sweltering hall. You want to keep risking our health and well-being for a bunch of skirts? The crowd buzzed with the sound of disgruntled voices. Yeah, do you think the men in the hole should be denied medical treatment or something? Another male voice added from somewhere in the middle of the room. Jean and her crew had quieted down by this point, but were still fidgeting, not really understanding what everyone was crowing about. She looked up at row after row of co-workers, many with wide sweat patches on their backs of their work shirts, and tried to make sense of what was happening. You listen to me, Denise said, now standing. Twisted to face the back of the room, her flax brown hair limp with sweat. I risk my life every shift in hot metal just like you. Last June, I got sent home early from a burn on my right arm. Don't think I don't get it. But I deserve to keep my job just as much as any of you men. We women kept stepping aside to let you have your jobs back now that the war is over, but enough is enough. She put her hands on her hips to emphasize her point and stood defiantly as the rumble of voices grew louder. Then John spoke. Well, I think you've made your point loud enough. Could you take your seat? After a second or two, Denise did just that by plopping in her chair. I assure you all, Mary said, we will do our best to work this out. We want everybody to be safe, but we don't want people to lose their jobs. More grumbling from the crowd. John, holding his chin in his hand, raised his eyebrows in doubtfulness, but said nothing. Jean whispered to Betsy, I don't think that's right. You know, those women losing their jobs? Just because they have to take out the ladies' room for the medic station? That doesn't even make sense, does it? Bessie shrugged and continued dabbing her damp forehead with her hanky. Listen, we have more business to get to, and we need to do it before this heat takes us all out, John said, interrupting what had become a free-for-all. Let's get to it. Jean spent the rest of the meeting thinking about these women who took the most difficult jobs in the factory to keep the business going while the men were off at war. And now they're losing their jobs because they are taking out their bathroom? She had gotten used to women workers being displaced as the men returned to claim what they had left behind, but this seemed to be entirely unnecessary. She was damn sick of being a second-class citizen. She had spent her childhood watching her grandmother and her mom drag their weary bodies to and from the glass house. She knew they worked just as hard as any man did and then went home to take care of their families to boot. They deserved the same pay and the right to keep their jobs. She looked up from her reverie as the room full of overheated workers began to rise and head out the tall double doors into the frigid afternoon. Her girlfriends were putting on their coats and giggling about something Jean had missed. She tried to join in on the fun, but couldn't stop thinking about how awful it would be to try to get by on a pay cut if she was caring for her family. Eventually, she shrugged and put on her coat, leaving it undone in the miserable heat as she followed her crew out into the street. Jean caught her breath in surprised exhilaration as the blast of cold air hit her chest and face as she walked down the assembly hall steps and onto the sidewalk. She shivered pleasantly as she tied her wrap around her waist. "Well, girls, we've got 20 minutes before our shift starts," she said. "Want to go for a cuppa?" And just like that, Jean was back at it, striding the few blocks down the street to Mitchell's to have coffee and maybe a bit of bread pudding with the girls before heading back over for her shift. Thank you.